Okay, good morning to everyone. It's a pleasure to be here today to have to host this workshop with Gregory Keating and Jenny Steele, Felipe Jimenez, Silvia Sorgetto. This is a workshop that is dedicated to Gregory Keating's latest book, which is Reasonable and Risk, Right and Responsibility in the Law of Torts, that was published less than 1 year and a half back in ago in Oxford University Press. And it's a workshop that culminates in a way a research that began more than 30 years ago. For a long time, I have been waiting this book, and I talked to Greg about it, because we had a lot of papers and book contributions that were very interesting, and in a way they offered a comprehensive view of tort law. So why not publish a book? This is what he told me the last time we spoke. I'm working on it. Now that the book is published, I think it was a great idea to discuss it, to gather some friends and discuss with him some important aspects of the book. Keating offers an original view of tort law that is very critical to the economic analysis of law, but it doesn't embrace either the corrective justice theories. It's not completely deontological either, because he has a strong interest in elucidating how tort law contributes to distributive justice, or which are the distributive justice effects of tort law and private law in general. And this way is in the middle ground that is sometimes difficult to articulate, that is has a very strong deontological component. Tort law is in part about interpersonal justice, but also is about distribution and sometimes efficiency. For example, in necessity cases, we're going to discuss about that later. And this makes it a pluralist theory of tort law, which are always, according to, from my point of view at least, very interesting and rich. As to the guest speakers, we have Jenny Steele. We have, as I already mentioned, I want her to be here and to visit us in Girona for a long time now. And this was a perfect opportunity because she has a very important background in subjects like risks. Her first book, I think it's the first book, Risk and Legal Theory, made a great impression on me when I was starting my PhD studies. And from almost 20 years ago, I have been reading her work. So I'm glad that she's here. And it's a perfect opportunity for her to be here to discuss this idea, reasonable and risk. Okay. The same happens with Silvia Sorgetto. She has published a lot in many subjects. She's a legal philosopher in general, with an economic background in economics, which is very rare in our academic environment. And lately she has published some works on risk and the principle of precaution in tort law and environmental law. And Felipe Jimenez, I already presented him yesterday for his seminar. He works in the philosophy of private law. He's a legal theorist also, a legal philosopher, but he has been publishing the last 5 or 6 years a lot of important work in the philosophy of private law. And the last speaker is me. I'm not going to present myself. I'm just here because I guess I'm a friend and organizer, so nothing to say about it. Okay, I don't want to spend more time. We're a little behind in according to our schedule. So we will start with the first speaker, and Carolina Fernandez Blanco is going to coordinate to be the chairperson for this presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Diego, and welcome everybody. Thank you for being here. And we are going to start with Professor Jenny Steele from University of York, the Law School of University of York, and she will present her paper, Heterogeneity, Tort and Risks. You have around 30 minutes for your exposition, then Professor Keating is going to answer in some way, and then we are going to open the floor to debate and questions. Thank you.
That's wonderful. Is my microphone working? Is everyone okay?
Maybe a little closer.
Maybe a little closer. First things first. Is that no? It is. Okay, that's great. I actually don't have a watch, so would you be so kind as to hold up 10 fingers and then five fingers to count me down when I'm getting close to the end? Thank you. First of all, thank you very much to Diego and to the team for inviting me. This is a great opportunity to visit Girona, where I've never been, and to visit a Spanish university to speak about torts, which is a wonderful thing to be able to do. And thank you to Greg for a great book, which we can see from the papers has really inspired a lot of thoughts of very different types from a lot of people. And when I decided what to speak about, what to select from the book to speak about, I contacted Greg, I contacted Diego, and I said, is anyone else speaking about heterogeneity? And nobody else was. Now, I think it's a really important element of the book. It's a really important element of the theoretical component of the book. And I wanted to pick that up and to say something about why I think it's important to start with. But then I've tried to take that a little bit further in relation to my own thoughts about tort law and in relation to my own thoughts about my particular legal system. And I know some of the papers refer to Anglo-Saxon systems. And of course, quite right, we have a lot in common. We have common roots in the common law, and English tort law was important at the start of American torts, but we've had a very long period of divergence and a very different structure to our legal systems. So there are big differences, but I think my message really is that the essential idea of heterogeneity and the two forms of responsibility primarily that are identified by Greg in the world of actions and the world of activities, that this is an incredibly rich idea that can also be developed. So that's what's the really the core of what I'm trying to say, is that heterogeneity is important. We need our tort theory to embrace that diversity. Diego has already been saying a pluralistic approach. But the specific strands in terms of those two worlds, I think we can develop even further beyond what Greg has been saying in the book. So that's the essence of what I'm trying to do. I now put on my glasses. I can see my paper, but not you. So the first part of the outline just revisits the fact that in reasonableness and risk, Greg sets out his stall against single value or single theory approaches. Obviously, that includes economic analysis of law in the form that it's usually found, but economics may be important in the operation of responsibility nevertheless. But equally, his approach is counter to other single theory approaches to tort law, and in particular, the sort of Toronto formalist approach where fault is the key idea that unites the law, at least in relation to negligence. And I think this is one of the things to say straight away, that Greg defines the core concern of modern tort law in terms of accidental damage. And I believe I'm right in saying that the theory as it's set out in the book is essentially orientated to that core concern. Now, there are parts of my thinking where it might be said, oh, well, you've changed the subject. You're not talking about accidental damage anymore. You're talking about other things. And I suppose my answer there is, Well, yes, but if we're trying to identify the core of modern tort law, we need to think about whether it's really still concerned with creation of damage, or whether it's equally concerned about how parties and societies try to manage those risks of damage. So I've tried to, and I think we can understand that better by thinking about Greg's distinction between the world of actions and the world of activities. But that needs a different application if we start to think beyond the creation of risk into how we manage risks. Greg emphasizes this divergence, the world of actions and the world of activities. I think that's a really striking way of putting it, a very useful idea, and I'm going to refer back to that as I go. He also emphasizes quite rightly that any single theory approach to tort law really does risk imposing on the subject of their analysis rather than interpreting it. And I think the word is used, purifying, which I agree, there's an attempt to purify the law rather than to fully go with the diversity that we can see in legal thinking. If the law is using different strands of thought, it would be hasty to say that's wrong. It would be more productive to do what Greg does and to try to understand why there is this diversity of thought. And importantly, we're not leaving behind notions of responsibility when we do that. We're not slipping into something that is contrary to responsibility, that is instrumental in some narrow sense. That means we are no longer thinking about who is responsible, but we are thinking about responsibility in a diversity of ways. And I think that's also significant, and another reason why I think heterogeneity is a very interesting and important strand in the book. And I just want, as the last part of this first part, I want to point out the emphasis on advancing security, advancing the security of important interests, but in the interaction between persons. So that is where we find tort law, in the interaction between persons and in the law's response to that. But what is it that tort does? Greg's argument, I think, is that it advances the security of important interests. And I think there's a lot in some of John Gardner's later work as well about security and the reason why we might have a tort remedy as opposed to some other kind of remedy. In fact, in Gardner's view, security was a really important idea and maybe the key idea that tort has to offer in political terms is the significance of security from harm. And so I think this also is very important. So why do I think heterogeneity is important per se? I think it tells us something about what tort theory can usefully do. And in that sense, as I've already suggested, it recognises that tort is a phenomenon which is there to be understood rather than to be purified and made into something completely different. Now, the formalist scholars would say it's everyone else that's turning it into something different. How do we know what it is? Well, we look at its form. But there's other ways of looking at it as well, not just through its form. Its form helps us to understand that it's about interactions between persons, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we have to understand it in one single way, that that's what it does. I think it's important that this allows us to see tort as related to other social and legal phenomena, like compensation schemes, Compensation schemes, of course, come in a wide variety. Some of them, as I think one of the papers has pointed out, are very far from the kind of responsibility we see in tort law, because they're public schemes where the sums to be paid come out of a public fund. Others are paid into by the broad class of people creating risks. And those could be seen as closer to tort law. We have a sort of responsibility at work, but it's less close to the world of actions. So we can understand tort and its relation to those administrative schemes without saying simply, oh no, that's not our concern. That's a different subject. Similarly with legislation, some years ago, I co-edited a book on tort law in the legislature, where we, a variety of great scholars, looked at the way that tort and legislation interact, the ways that tort and legislation interact, and what they offer to each other. And in terms of pluralism, I think it's right to say again that ideas, concepts and notions of responsibility can be quite fragmented in the law, but still existing, still having some power, and they can move between statutory and common law sources. Simon Deakin wrote us a great piece about workers' compensation, which is another subject that Greg covers in the American concept, and how ideas shift and concepts and sets of words shifted and evolved through tort law, workers' compensation, and back to tort law, because we no longer have it in the UK. Haven't had it since 1948. So this approach can mean principles can be in tension. There's a fruitful tension described in the book between different forms of responsibility. Being in tension, philosophically, doesn't mean one of those sides must be wrong. There can be tension between ideas of responsibility. At least I put that forward. Others who are more philosophically able may tell me whether that's true. I think the book recognises that richness is not incoherence. There's a big hang-up, I would say, with coherence. Coherence, obviously, is desirable, but it's not the end goal. To be coherent could be anything. The need to change over time doesn't mean incoherence. It means receptiveness to different ideas about responsibility. So does that mean we don't really have something called tort law then? It's simply a ragbag of ideas. Well, I think that the interesting turn here with heterogeneity in place is to understand tort in terms of, and I think these are the words in the book, its stable role and its enduring concerns. So what does it actually do? And again, I think there's a temptation to say, well, that's instrumental then. That's not philosophy of responsibility, that's just instrumental. Well, in a sense, it's instrumental, but anything that describes an area of law has to be at some level instrumental. But, you know, why do we have it? And it has a stable role and it has enduring concerns about how parties should interact and how we allocate responsibility for things that go wrong during the interaction of parties. It's easier, perhaps, or better to define tort in those terms than in terms of a single principle that we say can be found within it. And I think that's, if I've understood it correctly, it's one of the most significant points that I would draw from the book. So heterogeneity doesn't destroy the ability of tort to subsist over time. We can still recognize it as tort. But it can adapt, it can interact with other things and still retain its identity. I think in some ways, formalist approaches are too nervous. They're too nervous about tort being destroyed. And I know that there have been big tort reform movements which have maybe fed this nervousness. And I come from a jurisdiction where tort reform has been much more limited. It hasn't been a big assault on the tort system. And in fact, our courts have sort of, I would suggest, have lent enough to deflect the issues. So when there's been legislation which has tried to make tort less disruptive, the courts have said things which have meant the legislators have said, oh, we're going to follow the courts. We're going to make sure that we put into legislation what the courts are already doing. So I think formalist approaches are too anxious about the value of tort, which sounds odd because they are saying it's this philosophically valuable way of analysing things. What I'm saying is we can be reasonably confident about the social need for tort and its enduring role over time. Okay, so I am from another common law jurisdiction, but there are big differences, and some of those differences were occurring to me as I read the book. And actually, I think there's an extreme scarcity of a direct form of enterprise liability for harms as an alternative to negligence in English common law, though there are statutory versions. Rylands and Fletcher, of course, was an English case discussed in the book. But in England, it's really been painted into a corner. And Greg says this, he calls it cabining. It's been shoved in with nuisance and restricted in a host of ways. What I think is quite interesting that in the case which did this, Transco, which did this most clearly, Lord Hoffman actually said, yes, we do understand the responsibility claim made by Rylands and Fletcher. It's not at all unfamiliar to us. You can see it in statute. We have a lot of statute, he said, which enshrines this form of responsibility. Therefore, we don't need to do it in common law. So it wasn't that he disowned this idea of responsibility for activities and creation of risk. It was that he felt common law was too much of a blunt instrument to need to do it when it was being ably done by legislation in different contexts. However, that's not to say that we don't use the idea of activity responsibilities, not by any means. So we don't have, I don't think, now that Rylands is really not applied very much, we don't really have a grand statement like the trainer type of statement that we can apply on your activity causes the risk, therefore at common law you are responsible for the risk, even if it was correct to take that risk. I don't think we really have a very strong direct version of that. And yet we do have, it seems to me, a notion of responsibility based on the world of activities. In fact, I'm not sure that tort law would really operate without that idea of responsibility for the world of activities. And therefore, I've begun to think that actually a good theory of tort law has to account for that. I recently contributed to a handbook on philosophy of responsibility, which had only a small section on law, a few of us writing about law, but I was very struck by the diversity of philosophical approaches to responsibility. And some people, I think Manuel Vaiakis has argued that actually when we look at tort law in operation, we have to understand there's more than one idea of responsibility at work. And even if we shift to something like a New Zealand compensation scheme, that too could be based on ideas of responsibility. So if philosophy has diversity in relation to responsibility, then tort theory should have that too. It doesn't help us, just in my view, to look too closely and exclusively at the formal nature of a tort action. And Greg's book, I think, helps us to understand that. So where do we have these ideas if we don't have the direct versions so much? Usually, a fault-based tort, if we're talking about accidental harm, there's usually a fault-based tort somewhere in the picture. But who is responsible for that fault-based tort? This is where I think the world of activities really does start to play a role. And I think it's well known that English law has very extensive vicarious liability. That vicarious liability, of course, has to be liability for a tort, but its justification is likely to appeal to ideas about activities rather than only about actions. We also have non-delegable duties, usually on the part of employers, created really for historical reasons, because employee actions were blocked through direct negligence and vicarious liability. A form of non-delegable duty was created. But again, this needs to involve some tort in the first place. But who is responsible for that tort? And I think here again, Greg has, in the book, explained things which are part of the basis of this, because he's explained that it's not just harm that becomes predictable with broader activities, it's also wrongs that become more predictable with greater activities. And I think you had the example of the sailors on shore leave. Now, what the sailors on shore leave are likely to do is wrongs. Wrongs can be predicted as well. If you run children's homes, unfortunately, over time, it has become clear that some people you employ might do things that are very wrong. So whose responsibility is this? And our law, based partly on the way that the Canadians were thinking, was able to accommodate that as vicarious liability. You could, as an employer, still have responsibility for the deliberate wrongs of your employees under some circumstances. So tort in the world of actions might be the gateway to tort in the world of activities, is what I'm now suggesting, a thought provoked by the book. So does English law really, how am I doing for time?
7 minutes.
Oh, okay, I better speed up. Does English law really concern itself, other than through statutes, with accidental harm from risks which are rightly taken? That's the question. It formally, perhaps it doesn't, because all of these avenues I've talked about are about responsibility for torts. So at the level of the action, no, that shouldn't have happened. But at the level of the activity, we knew it would happen at some point over time, these things would happen. And we don't try and stop good activities from occurring. So the world of activities, you could say, yes, it was fine to run the risk of these torts, but the level of actions, it's only if it is a tort that we invoke the world of activities. Seems to be the case. Now, in practice, this can be fudged quite a lot. Forensic examination of whether there is a wrong can be close, or it can be rather general. And so, for example, in the case of historic liabilities for asbestos exposure, where English law has fallen over itself to create or recognise liabilities to injured workmen, Whether there was a wrong might depend what context you're in. Whole industries have had a date of knowledge attached to them, which is actually quite demanding. When should they have realized they were exposing the workmen to harm? And it would have been when a scientific paper was published, which revealed the connection to this type of harm. On the other hand, more recent cases have been brought against schools and universities, and in those cases, a lot of them have been dismissed because, oh, the university wouldn't have known that there was this danger. So how we understand the wrong and how closely we, or how demanding we are of people in relation to the wrong, even if we call it negligence, will help to determine, are we looking very closely at actions, are we looking mostly at activities? So I think English law slips around between these two without really saying so. I'm going to mention the change in 2013 for liability in relation to breach of health and safety duties at work. So we had a lot of health, and we still have them, health and safety duties of various degrees of strictness. Some have been described as absolute, others as strict. And breach of those duties for a long time gave rise to civil liability. The idea being there was less need for evidence. Employers have to be insured anyway. Workmen have suffered a harm. This is disproportionate to the benefit. And therefore, it makes sense in terms of responsibility as well as efficiency to have these liabilities. Now, in 2013, our Conservative government decided to remove civil liability from these strict duties. You now have to show negligence in the workplace again. Why? Because it was too much interference with the activity which gave rise to the employment. There was really no justification for it because insurance premiums were getting smaller because accidents were reducing. It was working. But it was part of the political agenda to remove that fetter, imagined or not, on activities. So what's happened in the courts, the Supreme Court's ruled that a reasonable employer will conduct risk assessments and anticipate risks. And it's openly said, we derive this from all the duties you're under, that you have been under for all these years. There are places where naturally there must be a divergence between strict liability and negligence, but the courts are pushing that boundary despite the removal of liability, civil liability, under the regulations, which are now criminal liability only. Okay. So how do I very quickly say something about these other ideas? So arguably, the focus of modern tort law isn't only on causation of accidental harm, but it's also on failures on the part of people whose role is to prevent or advise or manage those risks. And there is a lot of litigation in tort law, which is about, to put it shortly, whose responsibility it was to secure the interests of the person who has suffered harm. So I would say this world of activities could be drawn more broadly and could encompass ideas other than the creation of risk, also in terms of who ought to secure the interests of the person who suffered harm. That is part of the essence of our modern society and the modern activities within it. Management of risks can be private, it can be contractual, tort operates around the boundaries of contract, it can be public. And I refer back to the comments that I made about different types of compensation schemes, for example, as only one example. I think one important thing that is in the book somewhere is that Keating does note that separate enterprises might be involved in one activity. Now, those separate enterprises might be related within a a corporate structure, but they might not. They might actually have nothing directly to do with each other, but be cooperating for the purposes of a contractual activity. That's what contracting parties do. And I think about work that already exists on networks of contracts, for example. Can we actually apply the idea of the world of activities to multi-party ventures, in which the question that often arises is, you know, something fairly normal might happen, like a workman on the ground does something wrong that leads to an explosion. Many people are involved in the enterprise that led to that explosion. The first step of vicarious liability might be easy enough, but once you have an insurer involved, they will, as a matter of course, be looking for other parties who maybe could also be drawn into the liability picture. And I have said that sometimes the presence of an insurer means more tort law, not less tort law, more tort law, as insurers try to argue responsibility ideas of an action type. This is what insurers do. We think of insurers in terms of activities, but insurers like to talk about actions because it's a way of deflecting some part of the responsibility. And I've said that even the continuation of joint and several liability in English law is actually a recognition of responsibility attaching to activities. We haven't, like many common law jurisdictions, have gone for proportionate liability rather than joint and several. They have been pressurized by lobbying by insurers. And English law, despite some pressure to do so, has maintained the line that we have joint and several liability. Dividing responsibility, unless it's contributory negligence, but I'll leave that to one side. Dividing responsibility is a matter for something beyond the party that suffers the harm. So I think the identification of a world of activities as well as a world of actions has broader and even more heterogeneous applications than the ones identified already in relation to the creation of risks, although that is rich enough for the book. And I've got time to say one more thing? Or well, shall I leave it there?
Just in time, but...
Okay.
You can add something.
Yes. I will simply say...
You're going to have some of my time.
Change. No, I'll just say change in response to new developments. The fact that people are consulting on where to place the responsibility, the liability responsibility, for the harm that will be done by autonomous vehicles, means that we are thinking in terms of these activities, multi-party interventions, where do we place the responsibility is a live question. And that, I think, bears out your progeny point. Okay, I'm sorry if I went over, I said I had no clocks.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
First, I want to thank Diego for organizing this. It's a real privilege. And Girona, not even the United States, has a wonderful center of legal theory. So it's a delight to be here, even with a long flight from Los Angeles. And I thank all the commentators for coming in and indulging me so much. And this was a wonderful comment. And I agree with pretty much everything. Let me see if I can elaborate and come back to the autonomous vehicles example. So one of the things which I think maybe gets short shrift, I've written some about it elsewhere, but I think you've written much more about it, is you can take enterprise liability ideas and infuse them in negligence. And when I'm sort of setting up the ideal types in the book, I want to connect enterprise liability with strict liability in its sort of purest incarnation. If you let the common law or the idea work itself pure, it gets strict. But tons of it, and maybe because in the United States the sort of rise of strict liability has been deflected about 35 years ago by the tort reform movement, it's come back in a sublimated form inside negligence. And it very much is a kind of liability for the of a world of activities, and it's a evidence of how plastic tort lies and how plastic negligence lies. And I think you're completely right to pick autonomous vehicles as the next place we're going to see this. And either rashly or because I needed the stimulus, I promised somebody I would write on autonomous vehicles, and I just got around the last week thinking, what am I going to say? But it also happened last week that there was stuff in the papers that Waymo, the AV company, I guess, has now licensed to start sending autonomous taxis around Los Angeles. I have no idea. Are they on the streets in Spain? Or? And so they're like kind of a live science fiction phenomenon. And here's why I think it really connects with your ideas and presents a number of interesting things for tort theory. One is, the first thing you think is, well, we're going to take these vehicles and we're just going to wedge them into our existing negligence framework, because that's how lawyers work. Lawyers take developments, and no matter what they are, they just wedge them into what you've got. And it's not like anyone's coming along and there are academic ideas of radical new schemes, including we could just have a tax system once we have perfectly autonomous vehicles, which we're not a long way from. But in fact, we're just going to adapt the existing negligence framework. And the second thought that hits you is, well, in ways that may be interesting or maybe so obvious they're uninteresting, the autonomous vehicle itself can only pass through responsibility. You can't, you know, say to the autonomous vehicle, you're going to be going to jail and you're also going to be going to traffic school and you're a kind of responsible moral agent, you shouldn't have been drinking, et cetera, et cetera. It's all what makes them spooky makes that also laughable, which is that they're not responsible moral agents. So the responsibility is going to pass through to them, to somebody else. And that just immediately puts the question of negligence is going to be who's got the supervisor responsibilities. And I think the insurance companies are going to be the principal combatant with clout fighting the autonomous vehicle companies, because the sort of early, very, very early, it's hard to diagnose the landscape, but I think what the AV companies would want, and it's much clearer if you take something like the self-driving mode of Tesla than it is if you take something that has no driver like a Waymo, is supervisory responsibilities on the driver, so that you would say the vehicle is at fault when it violates the relevant traffic statute or any other established negligence norm, but pass the responsibility through to the driver on the ground that the driver has supervisory responsibility to make sure the vehicle complies with all relevant laws and driven responsibly. And that's really a stretch if you think of Waymo, because that would be the passenger in the taxi who is utterly implausible. And the alternative is going to be to pass it through to, well, either the operator of the vehicle like Waymo or to the manufacturer, designer, the software. You're going to have this complex enterprise and great difficulty figuring out how could your blind defect belong to that kind of an entity. But all of it, and I think the insurance companies are going to push strongly away from liability on the drivers. And there are reasons for that that are sort of, I don't know if it's called human factors engineering, but people are very, it's one thing to have a car that has safety devices that correct for your weaknesses, like blind spot monitoring, automatic braking. Those things tend to make drivers drive more safely, but we are not good at monitoring something that is just fine and then until it isn't. Yeah. And in the split second you have to take control of it, that's something human beings are not very promising responsible actors for. So the insurance companies will not want the kinds of liability that are landing on insurance companies under a scheme where there are supervisory responsibilities on fundamentally on the drivers of the cars. And they will push for a default rule of liability, define the enterprise in some way, and let it sort it out internally. And that would be a more rational way probably to go in the long run. But whatever it is it's going to be a hybrid regime of taking negligence rules and using them to structure a form of activity liability with various institutions, and it's going to make a lot of supervisory responsibilities. And those supervisory responsibilities have an independent significance as your discussion of vicarious liabilities and non-delegable duties. And They are, I would imagine this is also true in England and the continent, but they're very fraught in the United States, which you might think is the residue of the Me Too movement, bringing, you know, questions of the responsibility of institutions for the way in which they enable, through the abuse of power, various kinds of sexual wrongs. And what you are seeing in somewhat cautious forms, because tort law is just starting to spread its wings after the wake of the tort reform movement, like the California Supreme Court, it's not directly addressed this question of non-delegable duty or vicarious responsibility for various things like sexual harassment and even rape much, though it has, but it's lately been addressing responsibilities of universities and various affirmative duties, and they are defining these broad duties on institutions. And, you know, so for one decision, UCLA, the public school in Los Angeles, the public university, had a case where one student attacked another student in a chem lab, and the student who attacked had a history with the university of needing mental health treatment. And the California Supreme Court said, yeah, you've got a kind of duty there. And when you think about that duty, it's a significant thing in tort law, because particularly if you come out of a tort theory tradition where conduct-based wrongs have been given a great deal of prominence by the corrective justice theorists and also by the civil recourse theorists who like to emphasize duty, partly to emphasize that tort is about responsibility, not an instrumentalist thing. Well, here what you see with duty is a very broad notion of responsibility. You can certainly find in philosophical literature, I think like Hart's lovely short essay on responsibility sort of defines responsibility as just being accountable for what happens in some zone that's assigned to you. And that's what's really being imposed on universities in the decision involving UCLA. It's imposed on another one that does involve abuse of athletes participating in Taekwondo on the USA Taekwondo Association. Says it doesn't reach the Olympic Association, which sponsors the Taekwondo Association. It does reach the Taekwondo Association, which sponsors the coaches, or licenses the coaches. And that's very, very important development, because it's exactly the development you're describing of supervisory duties. And it's a very significant development for tort theory, because it is the articulation of negligence in kind of my terms, enterprise liability ways. But it's also the articulation of duty in extremely broad ways, so that a duty is a kind of responsibility for a domain that might be cashed out in all kinds of diverse precautions. It's not going to be just one precaution, but it's going to be a variety of steps. And ultimately, it's going to interact with actors who are often outside the institution. Like, you license the coaches, you don't actually supervise them. And that, I think, is all the kind of negligence law asserting a response to the world of activities. And very important, and in many ways, reasonably encouraging, too, I think, like a tribute to the plasticity of negligence law. But it also does, in an important way, and since I guess I come up rather strongly against the formalism of tort theory, I might as well do it again here. It does underscore why you get an unnecessary rigidity in tort theory when you push too far in the Canadian direction, because you don't want to define duty in advance as just tied to conduct-based wrongs. That would tie you in knots when you have to confront a circumstance like, how do we think about the responsibility of an institution for various activities it sponsors, or various activities where it sets the stage and other actors operate on that stage? It's not the right notion. And we have available very rich notions of law and philosophy that we can use. Thank you very much. That was very charitable and very helpful.
Thank you to both of you. And